The following is an Audio Renaissance presentation.
Quote, "They moved like a saucer skipping across water," unquote. The man who spoke those words was Kenneth Arnold, an Idaho businessman and an experienced private pilot. And those few words gave a new impetus to one of the most controversial and hotly debated issues in human history, the possibility that Earth is being visited by creatures from other civilizations. On June 24, 1947, Arnold was part of an airborne search team looking for a plane that had crashed in Washington State's rugged Cascade Mountains. He never sighted the wreckage of the lost aircraft that day, but what he reported he did see near Mount Rainier was amazing. An apparent formation of 9 shining disks, weaving at high speed in and out of the mountain peaks. From Arnold's remarks, a reporter coined the term flying saucer. The catchy description captured the public's attention and soon became a household phrase, and the modern era of UFO investigation was underway. Emotions run high on this subject. Many believe, absolutely, that UFOs are real. Many believe, absolutely, that they are not. This polarity of total acceptance on one hand and utter disbelief on the other sometimes makes it difficult to distinguish fact from fallacy. Are UFOs real? On that point, there is ample room for debate. What is not debatable is this. The UFO phenomenon is real. Reports of unidentified flying objects are real. Whatever their cause, the sightings exist in such staggering numbers that they cannot be ignored. And how many sightings go unreported because of the viewer's fear of being called weird or nuts or worse? In this program, we'll scan the historical record, present information and opinions from those who have investigated the subject, and talk to people who claim to have been contacted or abducted by aliens. In many ways, the world of UFOs is a world of what if. We're certain that you will find, as we have found, some of what you're about to hear both highly speculative and controversial. It's not our intention to prove or disprove any theory on UFOs. We advocate no position other than open-mindedness. Something is causing this phenomenon. Something is going on. And it may have been going on for a very long time. The first and perhaps the greatest controversy we face in examining UFOs is not whether they exist, not whether they're from another planet or galaxy or dimension. We face a much broader question of the very nature of our own humanity. Creationists and evolutionists have battled for decades over the genesis of humankind. But some who study UFOs have introduced a new element into the debate. Their theory is that our species may be the result of an alien genetic experiment, that Homo sapiens was created by extraterrestrials, or ETs, who interbred their own species with prehistoric ape-like hominids. Those who believe this theory claim it explains the current rash of reports from people who say they've been abducted by aliens and forced to undergo horrifying medical examinations. These believers say the genetic experiment, us, is still in progress, and like any experiment, needs to be continually monitored. Barry Taff is a scientist in biomedicine and psychophysiology, the study of the interaction of the brain and body. He is also a researcher who, for over 20 years, has explored paranormal phenomena and UFOs, and has written extensively on these subjects. In part, his remarks, which you'll hear in a moment, are based on interviews he's conducted and documents he and others have studied that focus on the possible crash of a spaceship near Roswell, New Mexico, on July 2, 1947. The Air Force initially called it a flying disc, and its wreckage was supposedly recovered, along with the bodies of its 4 crew members. According to some, as part of the Air Force investigation of the incident, autopsies were performed on the aliens. Here are some of Mr. Taft's thoughts on the links between ETs and prehistoric humanity, and the staggering impact this discovery could have if it were proven to be true.
The human race may have been genetically engineered by these beings visiting Earth now. We may be the result of someone else's experiment. And the evidence for that is fairly impressive based on the autopsy data from the deceased bodies recovered from the crashes. with regard to whether the human race is human or we're human, but, you know, they always talk about a missing link. I mean, Neanderthal man had a larger cranial capacity than we did. Then we had Cro-Magnon, we had other forms of primitive humans. What's intriguing is, you know, where did we come from? I wouldn't be surprised at all if a million some odd years ago, some beings like the ones we're running into now in these abduction scenarios dropped in and genetically re-engineered some hominids here, and we're the result. The missing link would be them. It wouldn't be another form of life. And again, the suggestion based on the autopsied aliens, or the what's called EBEs as we call them, strongly suggests links to us that they may have once been like we were, and they are trying to produce a species that was different than them, but not quite what was here. And given evolution as it took its course, we may never have evolved on this planet naturally. We don't know that, but again, this is strongly suggested. And what will this do to religion? If they're playing God, I mean, if they created us, who created them? What happens if someone breaks the news to the world that, hey guys, we're somebody else's bacteria and somebody else's test tube? And that's another reason why the government might want to withhold information on this level, because it's too powerful, it's too damaging to the ego structure of the human race right now to release this type of information. From a sociological point of view, the impact could be devastating. It could be as bad, if not worse, than another war, because a lot of people live their life for another life that follows this one, thinking that their God, or our God, or whatever you want to call it, him, is there to protect us. And what if we realize that we were genetically engineered by some other life form?
At first, the thought of our ancestors being in contact with powerful beings who could fly may seem new, strange, and different. But it is, in fact, an ancient idea. In the art, folklore, and literature of cultures throughout the world, we find references to humans interacting with flying gods. The legends of some American Indian tribes speak of a thunderbird. Eskimo mythology refers to gods with brazen wings who brought the first tribes to the north. Ancient Indian Sanskrit texts describe vimanas, objects that sound very much like aircraft, in which gods did battle in the skies using terrifying weapons. Consider these words, excerpted from the Mahabharata, quote, "A blazing missile possessed of the radiance of smokeless fire was discharged. Evil-bearing winds began to blow. Clouds roared into the higher air, showing blood. The world, scorched by the heat of that weapon, seemed to be in a fever. The very water being heated. The creatures who live in the water seemed to burn. The steeds and the chariots, burned by the energy of that weapon, resemble the stumps of trees that have been consumed in a forest conflagration," unquote. Was this a vision created by a writer who was simply attempting to give his deities unmatched powers? Or was it an eyewitness account of a nuclear explosion? Do other passages from that text describe powerful lasers? Questions such as these defy our traditional views of history and archaeology and challenge us to look at our past in a new light. Of the contemporary authors who have led us to new perspectives of ourselves, perhaps the most famous is Eric von Daniken. When his book, Chariots of the Gods, appeared in 1967, it created a sensation and triggered a global controversy. Other books followed in rapid succession, amplifying his beliefs that our planet was visited in the distant past by alien beings, that ETs did create human intelligence through a process of controlled mutation, and that these prehistoric visits produced our religions, myths, and legends. He further states that evidence to support his theories is all around us, if we will only see. He cites the writings of many cultures that tell of gods coming from the skies, and asks us to take those stories more literally than symbolically. He points to paintings, carvings, and artifacts from all over the world that may depict aliens and spaceships. Do they? An ancient stone relief from a pyramid in Palenque, Mexico, shows a man reclining in a position similar to the posture assumed by an astronaut in a space capsule. He is surrounded by what may be drawings of complex machinery, and the carving at the bottom of the relief can be seen as a flaming rocket exhaust. In Australia, we find rock paintings of beings the Aborigines call Wangina. One shows a standing figure staring toward us. It appears to be dressed in a close-fitting cloak. The face is featureless except for two dark almond-shaped eyes. Around the head, which is of human proportions, is drawn a circular line that brings to mind a spherical helmet. A number of hieroglyphic markings adorns the top of this helmet-like circle. Could this be a primitive rendering of a space-suited alien? Von Daniken believes it was. He also questions how, without assistance or direction from beings of superior intelligence, how our ancestors could have developed the knowledge that would enable them to build the pyramids, erect the massive stone heads of Easter Island, or carve out the mysterious lines on the plain of Nazca, Peru. 37 miles long, a mile wide, this dry, hot, remote plain high in the Andes is covered with lines laid out in strange geometric patterns. Some think they're a network of roads or irrigation canals. Von Daniken thinks they're something else, an alien airfield. From ground level, both the pattern of the markings and the designs of the enormous drawings among them are obscure. But when seen from above, the area does look like an airport, with a complex layout of intersecting runways and taxiways. Central to Von Daniken's theory is the fact that the drawings are only comprehensible from above. Only from the air can it be seen that the drawings depict stylized insects, animals, and birds. Spiders, spider monkeys, hummingbirds, lizards, and more, some of them hundreds of yards across. Only from the air is it clear that the lines resemble an airfield. Was Nazca a spaceport? Apparently, the lines were designed to be seen by something or someone in the sky. The question is, what or who? Could Von Daniken's beliefs be correct? Or has he merely created a complex jigsaw puzzle, then twisted and shaped pieces of evidence to fit his hypothetical picture, however awkwardly? His work has been both widely praised and roundly attacked. Some claim that his research is often careless, his books are riddled with errors, and many of his mysteries are not mysterious at all. Whatever the merits of his scholarship, it is indisputable that Von Daniken and other writers who explore the possibility of ancient astronauts have achieved a remarkable accomplishment. Their popular appeal has created a climate of intellectual freedom and wonder in which people can consider the possibility of the impossible. Von Daniken may be the best-known author in this area, but he was not the first. With the warming climate of Glasnost, more information is now coming in from the Soviet Union about their experiences with UFOs. Sheila Ostrander and Lynn Schroeder are the world-renowned co-authors of many books, including the groundbreaking Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. This work, updated and revised with new information, is also available as an audio Renaissance tape on the Soviet view of ancient alien visitors. Lynn Schroeder.
Soviet scientists were investigating what we call chariots of the gods or visitation of the gods long before it became popular in the West. And what's interesting about it in the Soviet Union is it's mainly people from real sciences, from large universities and the Academy of Sciences. Principal among them is a man named Dr. Vyacheslav Zaitsev from the Belarusian Academy of Sciences. He's written many books diagramming his theory of cosmonauts from outer space. In fact, one of them is called Jesus Christ Cosmonaut. And the idea is that many of the things we read about in the Bible were really literal accounts of gods coming from outer space to train us. They've sent expeditions, for example, to places like ancient Sumerian cultures, which, oddly enough, did appear sort of in a flash, and the legends from that culture, as the Russians say that gods came to instruct them. They also talk about archaeological ruins that they have found in far eastern Russia, where they excavated certain drawings that look cosmonaut-like of primitive statues, and also so-called stone records, which are covered with tiny little grooves, which many people there have theorized have to do with people landing and leaving messages from outer space. It's a much more common idea in the Soviet Union. I think they have a much more friendly idea about people from outer space, of how they have helped us in the past and are probably going to help us in the future.
Like their Soviet counterparts, many Western scholars have probed the Old and New Testaments and discovered a substantial number of possible UFO and alien references in the Bible. Some believe that at the time of the Exodus, the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night that led the Israelites out of Egypt was a UFO. This same craft, using a form of anti-gravitational beam, may have parted the Red Sea for Moses and his people to cross. Others believe that on Mount Sinai, Moses boarded a UFO to receive the tablets containing the Ten Commandments. Still others think that the Star of Bethlehem that guided the three wise men to the Christ child was a UFO. But one of the most intriguing biblical passages is the vision of Ezekiel, who, as the spiritual goes, saw a wheel way in the middle of the air. Excerpts from Scripture tell us that, appearing from the midst of a fiery cloud, Ezekiel witnessed the likeness of four living creatures. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one had four wings, and the soles of their feet were like a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. And they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. Their wings were joined to one another. They turned not when they went. They went everyone straight forward. For centuries, Ezekiel's vision was accepted as a purely mystical experience, expressed in an allegorical style. But some have taken the prophet's description and expressed it in terms of 20th century technology. One man who did so is Joseph Blumrich, author of the book The Spaceships of Ezekiel. Blumrich is worthy of note because of the uniquely impressive credentials he brings to his work. From 1959, he was an engineer designing and building aircraft and rockets, and he worked for NASA as the co-builder of the massive Saturn V launch vehicle that took the Apollo astronauts to the moon. According to Blumrich, the four living creatures were the four legs of a spaceship that had a body shaped rather like a child's top with concave sides. Each leg had a freely rotating wheel at the bottom, and helicopter-like rotor blades were the wings. Control jets and a central rocket engine firing as the ship descended created the fiery cloud of exhaust gases from which the prophet's vision emerged. Did Ezekiel see and later travel on a spaceship? Like so many mysteries surrounding UFOs, this one remains unresolved. Between ancient times and the present day, UFO sightings continued, although perhaps understandably, the record is somewhat sketchy. In the past, those who admitted to seeing strange things in the sky were sometimes met with deadly ridicule or intolerance. Consider the story supposedly handed down from the time of Charlemagne in the late 8th or early 9th century. At that time, three men and a woman were reportedly taken aboard a spacecraft and shown many wonders. But when they were returned to Earth, their fellow Earthlings thought them to be members of the alien race, whom they regarded as sorcerers. The innocent voyagers were stoned to death for, quote, being in league with the devil, unquote. On the night before he sighted the New World, Christopher Columbus and one of his crewmen aboard the Santa Maria reputedly saw a mysterious light glimmering at a great distance. The light appeared and disappeared several times. In 1561, the residents of Nuremberg, Germany, were startled to see dark-colored balls and discs in the sky. The strange objects were visible for about an hour, then seemed to fall to the ground and disappear. The phenomenon occurred again in Basel, Switzerland, a few years later. Edmund Halley, who gave his name to our galaxy's most famous comet, is said to have sighted UFOs in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. Perhaps the first UFO pictures in history were taken in 1883 by Mexican astronomer José Bonilla. While working in his observatory in Zacatecas, he apparently witnessed as many as 200 luminous objects passing across the face of the sun. But his indistinct photographs could not establish the reality or identity of the strange cigar and spindle-shaped objects in the sky. One of the most remarkable American series of UFO sightings took place in the late 19th century. From November 1896 until May 1897, thousands from California to Ohio and West Virginia reported seeing a mysterious airship. But there were no airships at the time. Although balloons and some lighter-than-air craft did exist, the Wright brothers' flight was still 8 years away, and nothing is known in aviation history that can account for these sightings. America wasn't the only place where UFOs were making their presence felt. Half a world away, in the Soviet Union, there were numerous sightings, and it is in a remote area of Siberia that we find the legacy of what may be one of the most powerful and deadly UFO incidents in human history. Lynn Schroeder.
The history of UFO sightings in the Soviet Union seems to be pretty much like the history of sightings everywhere else in the world. People in the many cultures in the far reaches of the land have been seeing UFOs since about the 1880s, when they described circular objects zooming across the sky. Again, in the early 1900s, around 1913, 1914, they saw flights or groups of these strange objects, which they said were circular in shape, zooming across the tundra and also over certain Soviet cities. The Tunguska disaster on June 30th, 1908, was one of the great disasters of this century. Suddenly, an object fell out of the blue morning sky and devastated 20 million square kilometers of Siberian forest. 10 million trees were destroyed. The shockwave was so great that it circled the world twice and was picked up on magnetic recorders. The only time since then such recordings have been picked up was when Americans and Soviets and French put off a thermonuclear blast. In the late 60s, the Soviets began to examine the Tunguska disaster more closely. Expeditions were sent out into the forest, which was very remote and very hard to get to. And what they discovered is this. According to the Soviet Academy of Sciences, whatever fell from the sky that day was not a meteorite, it was not a comet. The explosion that happened was an atomic explosion. They found artificial radioactive isotopes in tree rings, and they now say it was definitely a thermonuclear explosion. One of the experts, Dr. Felix Ziegel of the Academy of Sciences, had also done some mathematical figuring, and he claims that whatever this was that came into Earth's atmosphere on that June morning made a big maneuver before it crashed or came down to Earth. Now, Zaitsev and Ziegel and many other scientists in the Soviet Union believe this was a spaceship that was out of control. So far, they haven't found a spaceship, and there's no proof for this, but then again, what else could it have been?
Through the first four decades of the 20th century, there were continuing but sporadic reports of UFOs. And then, in the 1940s, the pace picked up. In late 1944, Allied pilots flying night missions in Europe began reporting encounters with mysterious glowing balls they labeled Foo Fighters, spelled F-O-O. At first, it was thought that the Foo Fighters were a secret weapon developed by the Axis forces. Only after the war did we learn that Nazi and Japanese pilots had also encountered the strange lights, and presumed they were a secret weapon developed by the Allies. The source of the lights remains a mystery. In 1946, in the skies above Scandinavia, there was an astounding number of sightings of ghost rockets, cigar-shaped objects with orange flames spurting from the tail. Again, they were presumed to be some sort of secret weapon. Again, their origin remains a mystery. But all these sightings proved to be only a prelude to the explosion of UFO events of the following year. Flying saucers became serious business in 1947. There was the Kenneth Arnold sighting, and then, some 2 weeks later, the landing or crash of something near Roswell, New Mexico. The initial Air Force press release created a sensation by stating in part, quote, "The many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality yesterday, when the 8th Air Force was fortunate enough to gain possession of a disc. It was inspected at the Roswell Army Airfield," unquote. The Air Force quickly changed its story to explain that the wreckage of the flying disc was really only remnants of a weather balloon. That may well have been the truth, but many found the explanation unconvincing. The controversial incident continues to challenge and fascinate many, and has been the subject of films, articles, and books, notably The Roswell Incident by Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore. Perhaps the Roswell case is the first case we have on record of what would come to be called retrievals of the third kind. Barry Taff.
The military has a team called the Blue Berets. Unlike the Green Berets, they don't go to war. This is the multi-service or inter-service rapid deployment crash retrieval team. When a vehicle goes down, this branch is sent out to cordon off the area, to secure it, and to bring back whatever they've gotten. The suggestion is, very strong suggestion is, that we've recovered a number of crashed vehicles, intact vehicles. In fact, I have a chance to speak with some people in one of the branches of our military that actually found an abandoned UFO in the desert back in the 60s. It was eventually hauled away. There's also the suggestion that one of these vehicles was tested and exploded with its human occupants on board during a flight test.
On January 7th, 1948, the UFO problem took on a new dimension with what may have been the first fatality that could be directly attributed to their presence. That afternoon, Captain Thomas Mantell of the Air National Guard was piloting one of a flight of F-51 Mustang fighters on a training exercise near Godman Air Force Base in Kentucky. He was asked to investigate a strange object in the sky, some distance from the tower, and gave chase. Nearing the target, he radioed, "It looks metallic and is tremendous in size." And moments later, "It's above me, and I'm gaining on it. I'm going to 20,000 feet. It was a fatal decision. He had no oxygen in his plane, and without it, could not fly safely above 15,000 feet. He blacked out and crashed. The official Air Force explanation that Mantell had died chasing the planet Venus was met with widespread disbelief. Rumors began to fly. Mantell was attacked by a spaceship. Not true. His body was burned by some kind of death ray. Not true. The Air Force is hiding something from us. Apparently, that was true. It seems that the Venus story was created because the Air Force could not reveal that Mantell had been chasing a high-altitude weather balloon, part of a then-top-secret project known only to a few. That official deception, however necessary, sowed seeds of skepticism in the public mind. It was suspected that a cover-up was taking place, a suspicion that has grown dramatically through the years. But what few people knew was that at the same time Mantell died, the Air Force was apparently not trying to cover up UFOs. They were, in fact, trying to discover just what these flying saucers really were. In late 1947, General Nathan Twining authorized the establishment of Project Sign, whose mandate was to investigate, quote, "all information concerning sightings and phenomena in the atmosphere which can be construed to be of concern to the national security," unquote. This began what would become a series of official investigative bodies, some of which were public, some of which, according to new evidence, were definitely not. Barry Taff is one who believes that the late 1940s saw the beginnings of a remarkable era of government information and disinformation.
Now, what's intriguing is that in 1947, the government began its first investigation, formally, as we knew it, the public, into UFOs, which was called Project Sign. The conclusion of the U.S. Air Force's study of Project Sign was that we were being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial vehicles, manned extraterrestrial vehicles in general, not unmanned probes. However, the head of the Air Force, General Hoyt Vandenberg, did not like that opinion. So they destroyed all 21 copies of that conclusion, and I think there was one that remained. There was a follow-up study called Project Grudge, which was appropriately named. The same conclusion was reached by Project Grudge. Well, the government was in a real quandary now, so it started Project Blue Book. Now, Project Blue Book was a twofold operation. One, it was to investigate public sightings of UFOs, and in that respect, it was to debunk the sighting to diminish its attention and awareness. However, the real phenomena, which was being heavily and thoroughly investigated by our government, had nothing to do with Project Blue Book. Project Blue Book was a disinformation public relations campaign by the Air Force to keep this quiet. In 1947, when the first crash occurred, President Truman was very concerned over what they found. And according to the documents that have been unearthed by Bill Moore and Stanton Friedman, President Truman formed a group called the MJ-12, Majestic 12, or Magic 12. And they were a group of 12 military intelligence officers, researchers, scientists. And these men were to act as a panel, totally autonomous to the president, to investigate and have at their disposal the military and resources they need to complete a full and thorough investigation of this phenomenon. And to our knowledge, this organization still exists. Top government people, top intelligence people, top military people, and top research scientists. And there have been a lot of interesting correspondence in Freedom of Information Act documents where the FBI has actually complained to the Central Intelligence Agency about the fact that they weren't given access to the crash vehicles or the bodies. Now, if there aren't any, why are they complaining about not having access to them? One in particular incident that happened when E.T. was made by Steven Spielberg, he was giving a private screening to President Reagan, and at one point President Reagan took Mr. Spielberg aside and put his arm around him and said, you know, Steven, there's only myself and a few other people in this room know how close to reality this film really is. And he was serious. He wasn't joking. I'd say that in terms of covert operations and cover-ups, as Stan Friedman would say, Cosmic Watergate, this would make anything in our history pale by comparison. The secrecy involved regarding this phenomena would dwarf the Manhattan Project that built the atom bomb. All that I know is people that have been in the government and in the military that have dealt with this phenomena have been debriefed and told never to discuss it, and they've been warned of the penalties involved, of jail, fines, threats against them, veiled threats. Again, if you want to keep a secret, people say you can't keep a secret. There are so many black projects right now in the government that I could go on for hours about what's happening that no one will know about for 25 years. If the government wants to keep a secret, it can. The way that does so is by compartmentalizing it and making sure that it's the only those people that need to know it. So, again, this is a situation where we can't control the flow of information as long as it's given to the right people, and it has been given to the right people.
It was, by the way, Edward J. Ruppelt, the first director of Project Blue Book, who in 1952 originated the term Unidentified Flying Object, or UFO, an attempt to create a more scientifically open term to describe the phenomena they were investigating. The legitimacy of the documents that supposedly established the existence of the MJ-12 group remains open to question. But many have also raised questions regarding the legitimacy of Project Sign, Grudge, and Blue Book. These investigations cumulatively spanned a period of 22 years, lasting until Project Blue Book was wrapped up in 1969. They conclusively established that most UFOs were, in reality, IFOs, identified flying objects. Stars, satellites, meteors, planets, swamp gas, ball lightning, missiles, mirages, fireworks, flares, earthquake lights, clouds, and other meteorological phenomena, to name a few. But some sightings stubbornly refused to be explained away. A yawning credibility gap opened between the government's position on and the public perception of the situation. This is not surprising, for some of the official flying saucer explanations put forward by the Air Force were unconvincing at best. For example, broken up crystallized meteors whose fragments caught the rays of the sun, and large flat hailstones gliding through the air. On the other hand, more and more people, including scientists, pilots, engineers, and even some high-ranking military officers, were coming forward with detailed eyewitness reports and the credentials to back up their stories. There may have been programs similar to Sign, Grudge, or Blue Book operating in the Soviet Union during this period. Considering the Cold War mentality of the time, the Soviets were probably working as hard as Western nations to determine if a threatening foreign power was behind the phenomenon. Certainly the Soviets saw many UFOs, but they handled the reports in a somewhat different manner.
In the late 60s, many interesting and outstanding Soviet scientists went on television to talk about UFOs. And when we were there, they had suddenly gone underground again in 1968. The authorities were rewriting history, which is quite usual in the Soviet Union, and saying no such thing as a UFO had ever been seen anywhere in the airspace over the Soviet Union. This was interesting because their own publications, such as Soviet Life and Pravda, had published large articles on this, complete with photographs and diagrams. Recently, with the warming climate of Glasnost in the late 80s, reports are coming again from the Soviet Union of UFO sightings and even in some cases reports of landings.
Other evidence continued to mount, including recordings of the kind you're about to hear. Because this tape is an actuality recording, its quality is less than ideal. But we present these excerpts because of their astonishing content. The tape was recorded on October 7th, 1965. Strange lights were reported near Edwards Air Force Base in California. Soon, Air Force personnel in three different control towers had the objects in sight, visually and on radar. Remember that these are not casual observers. They are highly trained, experienced men, familiar with the skies and virtually everything in them. We begin with a segment from a call to the base commanding officer, explaining the situation.
We have about four objects have been in the system for over an hour in the vicinity of Edwards Victorville. Actually, they're pretty close to over Sanford, too. Everybody around them has had radar and visual obs on them, and their flashing lights, etc., running in the vicinity of 4 to 12,000 feet in various observations.
The scene now shifts to the desert as the air controllers try to track and identify the strange objects.
Your first one was 135. Your second one should have been about a 145.
I have one in that area.
You have one in that area also?
Three of them in a row.
Right.
About 145.
The March approach is spinning these three also.
Right. If you have one at 090, we do not have that one, but we do have the other two.
The tower? Yes. If you look to the north of us, there's one coming pretty fast. And you basically see his movement. And he's coming from north to south.
He's north going south.
He's right over the runway.
He's right over your runway?
He's about to pass over the way he's moving. There's something right over Edwards at this time.
I got a piece of that up there.
He's moving southwest.
Right, I'll
confirm that. It's a white, he's going white red. That's what he said. I'll confirm that. This is the tower at Edwards. We have an object now over the field.
He is right over the field.
Right over Edwards, moving southward fairly rapidly.
Roughly what altitude?
Do what?
Roughly what altitude?
20 to 30,000.
20 to 30, roger.
Matt, did you scramble on this or what?
Yes, we have an aircraft due off in 11 minutes.
Where's he coming off from, Vlad?
Victorville.
He's coming out of Georgia.
Okay, we'll take this bird, this South Lima 01, take him out to Edwards, and then we'll train with a 145 heading and see what happens.
Alpha Lima 01 is a supersonic reconnaissance plane. You will hear the towers working in unison as they try to direct the fighter to intercept the targets they have on their radar scopes.
Okay, Edwards Tower.
Yes, sir.
WD. Okay, Alpha Lima 01 is now bearing about 195 for 15.
Give
him in sight.
Yes. Yeah. We got some more up, partner.
Okay, go ahead.
To the north of Bora.
Okay, Tower, pick out one you want us to intercept, and we'll take a 01 in on him. Okay, interceptor searching high now. Look, about 220 for 5 miles or so.
220?
Alpha Lima 01 has a contact about, he says 15 right, or 20.
220?
Right.
All right, I have Alpha Lima in sight now.
Yeah, he says he's got a contact, 12 o'clock 16.
That's it.
Where's our blip now?
He's running between two of them.
Okay, Alpha Lima 01, you close in on that object. We just made it pass that.
You got any contacts out there?
Contact,
all right, keep going.
Left turn. He's low and left. That thing is rising.
Tower, how's things look now?
He's low. Look, search high.
He's doing a search high.
Search very high. The thing is rising. It's rising rapidly.
He's way low. Way low. 40,000 feet.
So low. It looks like it's right above him from the tower now. It looks almost directly above him and rising.
The objects climbed and quickly vanished. Tower personnel and the pilot were debriefed without result. So far as we know, the strange lights have never been explained. Historically, UFO sightings have tended to come in waves. There was such a wave around the turn of the century, another in the late 40s, another in the late 50s and early 60s. Today, there is another. But today's wave has a different focus. It centers on people who claim they've been abducted by aliens. It's not that abduction stories are new, but never before have they been reported in such astounding numbers. Never before have we heard such extraordinary details of the experience. And, as Sheila Ostrander explains, it is not an exclusively North American phenomenon.
There have been reports of UFO abductions reaching the West just recently. In June of 1975, a Soviet Army major was allegedly abducted in a UFO. In 1978, there was a UFO wave over Poland, and during that time, apparently a 71-year-old farmer, John Volski, was allegedly abducted. Hungary has had a rich history of sightings of UFOs, and they claim possibly the first UFO abduction of modern times. This took place on Christmas Eve in 1903 when a woodcutter called Ivanko was apparently witnessed being taken up in a glistening ball which lighted the entire area.
At the end of the film Close Encounters of the Third Kind, we saw Richard Dreyfuss going aboard a crystal spaceship in the company of kindly aliens. If aliens have really been abducting Earthlings for centuries, they might look similar to the creatures in that film, but they may not be nearly so benign. Our history is filled with abduction stories, some possibly genuine, some fraudulent. One of the latter category of abductees was occultist and mystic George Adamski, who claimed that in the early 1950s, he met and traveled through space with Venusians. Another highly publicized and highly suspect contact story of the period comes from Brazil. In 1957, a farmer named Antonio Boas reported having a passionate sexual encounter aboard a flying saucer with an incredibly beautiful 4.5-foot-tall alien. But much of the laughter that met such wild tales stopped with the story of Barney and Betty Hill. In his book, The Interrupted Journey, author John G. Fuller tells how, on the night of September 19, 1961, the Hills were supposedly taken from their car. They were brought aboard a UFO, physically examined, and then returned, with their memories wiped clean of the incident. Through regressive hypnosis, the Hills came to recall the details of their alleged kidnapping. There is no doubt that the Hills had some sort of traumatic experience, but it may not have had anything to do with extraterrestrials. Were they recalling a shared dream or fantasy? Were they recalling an actual event? Or something in between? The same questions are being asked of today's abductees. Credibility of the witnesses is a key issue. Why are they making these claims? To get attention? For some financial gain? This may be true for some, but certainly not all. Most have nothing to gain by revealing their stories, and in fact suffer ridicule and psychological anguish when they do. Why then do they make up such tales? The answer may be that they aren't making them up. Debate rages on the reality of abductions, fueled on one side by books such as Bud Hopkins' Missing Time and Intruders, Whitley Strieber's Communion and Transformation. On the other side, we have books such as Philip Glass's UFO Abductions, A Dangerous Game. Sometimes it seems that the abductees are caught in the middle, just trying to understand what has happened and is happening to them and come to grips with it. We would like you to meet Michael and Diana, two people who've had dramatic experiences of alien contact. Michael's story follows a classic abduction scenario.
I was living in Baltimore at the time, and I was visiting my girlfriend. I was driving home from Frederick on Route 40. I saw lights starting to follow my car. They came down out of the sky. It was very late at night. They then flew off, and it scared me very badly, of course. And the next thing I knew is my car was ripped off, literally ripped off the side of the road of the highway. And I thought I was going to crash. The next thing I remember is I must have hit my head or blacked out or something, because I remember sort of staggering out of the car, climbing, sort of staggering around to the right side of the car. I was off the highway at this point. And there was a bright light in front of me. And I looked to the right, and there were five little guys. I was led into a saucer, for lack of a better word. And I was led into a room, and some sort of an operation was performed on me. I thought that I was somehow a little bit different, maybe a little unusual. maybe singled out because, for example, I was in very good health, I was a professional athlete. In retrospect, I don't think any of those things were the reason. I think my feeling is that it was very random, that I was in the wrong place at their right time.
Let us mention here that if you're interested in learning more about Michael's story, you'll find it told in much greater detail in Chapter 3 of Bud Hopkins' Missing Time. Abductions follow broad general patterns, but within that loose framework, the experiences vary widely. Diana recalls that her first alien contact occurred when she was 2 years old and frightened her terribly. Her perspective is very different from Michael's. She perceives contact as happening through a shifting and vibrational energy, an interdimensional passage. And while Michael feels he was chosen at random, Diana has a much clearer idea of why she is being contacted.
My researchers have taken me into some very extraordinary fields, and it is my ultimate belief that it is a form or a state of consciousness. It's a raising of consciousness in a certain way. The UFO experience is a form of doorway. To me, it is a dimension that's intruding. Sometimes we can get across, sometimes we can't. And for some reason, whether it is by some circumstance around us that forces us into it, or something we do to ourselves, we seem to make this crossing across this area. Now, the interesting thing about this is that they, the UFOs, seem to be coming the other way as well. I have a sense that they're coming. I know that they're coming maybe 1 or 2 days before, or that there is a contact that is necessary. I then sort of appear to walk around in a trance for a little while as I'm beginning to disconnect, let's say, from the physical world, and I'm moving more into this state of awareness. Even though I can be aware of what's going on around me, I am sensing another something or realm. And in my case, because I had the frightening experience as a child, I'm still unwilling to see them physically. And so my contact is always in an unconscious state, a sleep state. My experience with them had a lot to do with the birthing of children and the bonding, particularly bonding. They were having a lot of difficulty with deaths of their particular race. For some reason, they had reached such a high state of technical, we would call it technical advancement, but it's like a hive mentality. They had one mind that they all knew what was going on at the same time, and they had lost that individual sense of attachment in some way. What I appeared to be doing there, and I have the sense that I was over there many, many, many times, was showing them, holding the children. I do believe, too, that there is one of mine there. That's a very difficult experience for me to talk about. I have a child there, and I have named her. Her name is Nell, and I was shown her. I do believe that they respect what I had to share with them.
Although their specific experiences are different, Michael and Diana have something in common. They both claim to have been physically examined, in the process experiencing a terrifying, even humiliating loss of individual will and control.
I was no better than a laboratory rat. That's exactly the way they made me feel, simply because they were doing things at their own pace with me, however and whenever they wanted to. I had a terrific sense of violation, particularly afterwards, and even now. And to a certain extent, even a little bit of anger. They would move my legs, they were touching nerves, at one point they opened up my back, they were examining my head, my chest, my heart, my brain. I didn't feel like a human being, I didn't feel like a person, I didn't feel like my personality was of any concern. And they seemed very efficient at what they were doing. They seemed to know exactly what they were doing.
I do feel violated and used, because very often you're out of control. The only way I can maintain my sanity is to keep my awareness or my curiosity open and try and get as much and bring as much back with me as I can. As long as I am in this state, I am not hurt or harmed in any way. But the paralyzing feeling that you have is so outrageous to most humans. In a sense, it's like a trustee, I guess, of a jail. You become used to being the prisoner, and you adjust to your environment. And I think, in a way, that's the only way I have been able to deal with it. This, of course, is the most difficult part to talk about, is the examinations, the probing. The one that I can't touch, or the one that is most personal to me, is the child. The egg that I think that was taken, the egg that was fertilized, the child that I was shown, this is still very overwhelming to me.
Finally, here are their thoughts and feelings on the nature and the possible reality of their abduction experiences.
It's very difficult to describe the experience because the knowledge you come back with is like mist or smoke. It is so intangible that I can't put it into a word, experience, a story that I can tell you. It's an encompassing, overwhelming, holistic experience. It's not logical. That's one of the things you have to understand. There is no logic to this at all. Even the things you see are not logical based upon our experience. They are illogical. Sometimes it's like looking at a hologram. The emotional impact of this is so incredible that I felt more alive during this experience than I have in my mundane life. And so to ask me the question, do I ever wish it had never happened? Yes, to a certain degree, to be able to function on an everyday existence. But to be alive is something that is a wonderful feeling, that sense of total involvement.
When you've had an experience like this, particularly when there's no one to relate it to, it's absolutely devastating in a way. It was very frightening. I had a lot of late nights where I was afraid to go to sleep. I suppose, you know, I was being unnecessarily paranoid that people were following me, watching me, that sort of thing. In the 12 or 13 years since this story came out, I don't want to be overly dramatic, but it has changed my life. It certainly forced me to accept the possibility, shall we say, of things that I really hadn't even considered before. I really don't know whether this happened to me or not. I guess I'm 50-50. I don't know for a fact that my mind is not somehow creating this story. I don't have answers. I spent time with several psychiatrists and psychologists, and all of them have concluded basically just a few things. Number one, I'm not lying about this. I took a polygraph test. Number two, whatever did happen to me was so extraordinarily out of my range of normal experience that it left a tremendous impression on me. In other words, that brings us to the third thing, and that is that something happened to me that was not in my imagination, that was external to my normal experience, and which traumatized me in a number of ways. I'm not happy. This is something I want to make very clear. I'm not happy that this happened to me, whatever happened to me. And I don't think it's a particularly unique thing. I have a very strong sensation that a lot of other people have had the same or similar kinds of experiences. And I've never met anybody who found it a joyful experience for them either. My feeling is that most people who listen to my story wish that this sort of thing could happen to them. I would really strongly beg to differ with them because I don't think they would find it, you know, such a terrific experience. There are a lot of times when I wish that this had never happened to me. It would have made my life a lot simpler. Things would be a lot more black and white. It's a very human thing to try to find an answer, or at least a logical possibility. I hope that in my lifetime, our government is willing to be reasonably forthright with people and at least admit that they're interested in the subject, that something's going on, and possibly even tell us what it is. I'm not out there trying to convert people. You know, I'm not asking anybody to believe what I have to say. I'm just telling a story that happened to me, and I'm trying to find answers. And if anybody has answers, I'd love to hear them.
Questions remain. One of the most important is, why are they here? If they are here, why? Again, we encounter that familiar polarity, only in this case, rather than reality, the issue may be good versus evil. Barry Taff and Lynn Schroeder.
And the reasons for coming here might be the same reasons we're going out into space, explore reconnaissance, or it could be something as simple as their biology 1A class. To them, we might seem like very strange creatures whose primary occupation is, you know, tribal warfare. We live in these strange metal boxes that spew out toxic fumes, and we go around killing each other on a daily basis. I, for one, would put myself in their shoes and say, why bother with these beings? If you work in a physiology lab, you work with monkeys and dogs and cats and rats, and you don't take them out to dinner and ask how their life's going and what, you know, how their families are, and you don't care. The behavior of these beings, if they are indeed beings, and as advanced as they are, they don't appear to be that much different than we are, is that they immobilize us, they tranquilize us, they abduct us, they experiment on us in the sense of examinations. They may take sperm and ova, suggested by Hopkins and other people, and other abductees, and they put us back.
Soviets seem to generally believe that the intentions of any alien visitors would be very good ones. We had one physicist from the University of Moscow tell us not to worry a bit about nuclear disaster because the UFO people would come like loving mothers and fathers from outer space to save us. That seems to be a general idea. It's also true in their science fiction. I think often in the U.S. anyway, in movies and science fiction stories, it's sort of this alien invader, whereas generally in their science fiction, it's this wonderful invader that comes to help us or to take us somewhere terrific.
Ultimately, we find ourselves echoing Michael's sentiments. Questions abound. Answers are harder to come by. Are UFOs real? We do not know. We have mountains of evidence of varying degrees of credibility, but we still lack conclusive proof. UFOs present as much of a challenge to us as they may have to Edmund Halley, or Ezekiel, or our prehistoric ancestors. We may discover the answer to the UFO mystery tomorrow, or never. Whatever our exploration of them reveals, the quest is worthwhile. Something is going on. If UFOs are a mass hallucination or fabrication, then they are worth studying to find out what our illusions may tell us about ourselves. If they actually exist, if we are on the verge of making contact, then we are also on the verge of the most profound changes in the course and fate of humankind since the beginning of time.